thanks for the kind of invitations. And when Dima was inviting me for this conference, I didn't realize that kind of what I'm facing today. And I quickly realized I'm the only experimentalist in the room facing a bunch of the theorists in front of me. And that really kind of scares me into death. And then I remember that my close collaborator, Igor Lyon, always kind of told me following suggestions. If you just in front of the theorist, the worst thing you just pretend is you know something. And then it's always safe to kind of behave, I'm ignorant experimentalist, teach me that what it is. So that's one thing. And the other part is I realized I think that most of this probably the interest of the workshop is a bit more kind of geared toward the strongly correlated systems and topological interpretations and their own. And the subject wise that I chose was a little bit kind of boring single particle physics. So some of may you think that, well, maybe this is the cute experiment, cute things, but maybe it's too easy for you. But my hope is, in fact, actually, some of the experiments we are seeing in such a simple system in the graphene, yes, many of the understanding is based on the single particle pictures, something that I'm going to discuss in a moment, but also that start kind of ties with some of the importance of the electron-electron interactions and maybe even further some of the kind of topological implications and so on, which actually I don't know anything about it for now. All right, so the problem that I'm going to discuss is about the topological, the Hofstadter's butterfly problems, and I want to kind of start with thank the my collaborators that make this work happen. That besides the two PIs that Jim Horn and Ken Shepard that we work together, there are the strings of the students, especially Corey Dean is a major player of all of the things I'm going to talk about. He's now moving to the CCNY, only 10 blocks away from the Columbia, and setting up his lab. And the students and postdocs coming from the kind of three groups actually make this project happen. Okay, so the problem setting is rather old problem, I would say. In 1976, the Douglas Hofstadter actually solved problems in his part of his PhD thesis problem. And so rather old problems called the Haphazard equation. And problem setting is kind of following thing. Let's think about the simplest two-dimensional system, periodic electric field, and then apply the magnetic field and ask what this energy spectrum should look like. Well, the simplest two-dimensional system you can solve in this particular case is just kind of think of a square lattice considering only nearest neighborhood hopping and tight binding model, the world's simplest problems one can solve, even I can solve. And apply the magnetic field there. You can quickly parameterize these problems in the Hamiltonians with dimensionless fields such that, well, how much field in the unit cell divided by flux quanta will give you dimensionless number B here. And your Hamiltonian is basically parameterized by the B. And since we are using the tight binding basis, if you just try to solve that, then you just come up with the equations that consist of the difference equations. And then solving these difference equations, what is called the Haphazard equations, you can get in principle the energy spectrum of the problem, right? Why this problem is difficult? And what Haphazard himself actually tried to attack this problem, he found that energy spectrum is rather complicated and complex. And the reason it becomes complex is clear that basically there are two competing length scale that govern the kind of the periodicity of the problem. One is, of course, the period is coming from the real lattice, where the length scale is governed by the lattice constant. But the other length scale that try to produce the problem of the periodicity is basically magnetic field. And basically, this magnetic length, S of B, is basically what governing the another periodicity. And these two periodicities can just kind of compete each other in this problem and can make this commensurations and incommensuration type of the problems there. Well, so what the Hofstadter did was that he actually assumed the first that, say, let's think about the simple case such that there's a commensurability. So if the B, the dimensionless magnetic field, can be expressed in terms of rational numbers, such as P over Q of these two integer, then you can kind of quickly show that because this is a rational number, if you simply make the unit cells Q times larger, and then everything becomes kind of periodic again within the so-called magnetic unit cell. And then you can choose that in such cases, your lambda levels in a high enough magnetic field will split into the Q sub band because of the Brillouin zone is the your real lattice becomes Q times larger. And then each of this sub band is a P-fold degenerate. So that's kind of, you can prove that well. And the problem is then, what if that the B is not the rational number? Every rational numbers, they're close by, infinitesimally close. There's always an infinite many uncountable number of the irrational numbers, which cannot be expressed in such cases, right? So some sort of maximal incommensurability can arrive there. So what he did was in using this 70s, mid-70s computing power, he's just explicitly calculate this problem and show that what is energy spectrum look like, right? And that's what actually comes out, this nickname of the Hofstadter's butterfly. So this is his original paper that I believe that he used probably Q as a 51 or some sort of large numbers and just kind of calculate basically matrix diagonalizations of the 51 by 51 type of matrix, right? So it's not a kind of complicated problems, but the result is quite kind of interesting. Here's the energy axis, and here is the magnetic field, basically flux, that unit normalized by the flux quantum. And what you see here is in this small magnetic field, more or less a really, okay, so the zero magnetic field, basically zero and one is your tight bind and two end. And there is a kind of band-like things comes out from the edge of this band. Basically, you can view that there were, here's a lambda level comes out. And then you start to break it off. Presumably, as you go to high magnetic field, electron orbits start to see that kind of what is the lattice should look like. So lambda level start to break down. And all of these kind of stories coming out. And spectrum becomes indeed rather complicated. Why it causes as a butterfly? Well, if you just look at this one, you look like the butterfly wings, and there's another butterfly's wing. Well, some people call this the Hofstadter moth, and some people call it the bat. Butterfly is probably a better name, right? But the point here is rather this structure is complicated, and Hofstadter actually claimed that, bold claim that, well, if you just look at this the spectrum carefully, that there is some self-similarity comes around, which means that if you look at the wings of the butterfly, indeed, there is a kind of, you can find another butterfly like the shapes, and another one. So basically, fractal-like the pattern is in there. And using this self-similarities, basically, Hofstadter claimed this is kind of one of the fractal you can view, and the rare example of the fractal. Now, when he actually claimed this is a really kind of quantum fractal, it was not really well substantiated, except that looking at this kind of image type of things. And I heard that his advisor, who was a 1 year, didn't believe that initially. And that's why, it's actually a rumor that I heard. That's why that this paper actually has his sole author name without his advisor, although this is his PhD thesis, right? I don't know about the detail. Maybe I'm supposed to see Hofstadter in the January in the KITP. So I'm going to ask whether that rumor that I heard is true. But what is true is 2 years from after this publication, Wani actually published a series of the interesting papers. And the paper contents is basically try to analyze the kind of details of the spectrum. And what he showed here is quite intriguing. There is in fact actually interesting mathematical structures there that described by this kind of Diophantine equations, and this is a rather important role later on. What he found is, if I just kind of stay in one of this gapped region of this spectrum, basically you can, as long as you just stay in one of the gap, there's always kind of two numbers you can associate. One is basically number of the electron filled up the any spectrums underneath of that gap, right? So well-defined number. And that basically also magnetic field at the point of the gap. And what Wani actually showed that is basically looking at this spectrum, as long as you are inside one of this gap or this, basically this Diophantine equation works, which means basically the normalized density normalized by the density per unit cell, and the field normalized by the flux quantum satisfy these equations consists of the two integer number, T and S here. So that's actually mathematical proof. You can just kind of show that in this problem. And then obviously the next thing is whether is this two integer numbers kind of important number. Turns out this the integer numbers is extremely important. Both of the integer numbers can carry some of the physical meaning. In particular, this number integer number t was quite important because later on, a few years later, that tied with this experimental discovery of the quantum Hall effect. In fact, this T is related with the experimental observable, such as a Hall conductivity in the system. And more importantly, because of this T is an integer number in this case, that proved that in some sense, your quantum Hall, the Hall effect you can measure in this type of system is quantized by the integer number times of E square over H quantum conductance. So that's basically the important work done by the Dowless and colleagues and TKNN. And about the same time, Strada also shows very similar relations that giving this some important meaning of this integer numbers in this this part. S is basically related with how many bands got filled up in this type of the spectrums. And so that's basically the meaning of these two integer numbers. So now having this integer numbers and to this all this gap, especially what I'm saying here is in this each of the gap, basically I know that what is corresponding Hall conductivity, quantized Hall conductivity. You can actually now pick up the any of the gap, and if you just choose integer numbers as corresponding one color, you can actually paint this spectrum into the color correspond to this gap associated with this integer number. Now this butterfly even acquired beautiful colors, and this was actually done by some of the mathematical physicists in some years ago, right? So once you see that now, this looks like not a moth, but a really butterfly, right? And this is kind of quite beautiful, and also it's kind of a rare example. You can see the fractals in the quantum theory. So it's obvious that while the theories actually claim that, well, so this is kind of interesting in victories on the single particle pictures, now this experimentalist task, can we actually find this and show that indeed this can happen in the real system? Well, the problem to realize this in the real system is, well, what you need to see this spectrum, you have to apply the magnetic field up to this about close to the one flux quanta per unit cell. But in the real atoms, that unit cell size is angstrom squares, right? A field that you need is like 10,000 Tesla. And that basically is not a kind of field that we can easily achieve in the lab, right? Unless you go to some astronomical object nearby, right? So that was kind of the difficulty. But then there is a way that you can overcome this one. Of course, you can make the artificial atomic arrays, artificial two-dimensional system. Indeed, throughout this the early 90s and kind of mid 2000s, what people try to do, experimentalists try to do, is create this atomic structure, the superlattice structures into the two-dimensional electron gas and periodic structures, and try to realize those kind of fractal spectrums you can see in this magnetotransport, under the magnetic field with these periodic electronic structures. The trouble of these experiments is done in mostly in the Klitzing's groups, and this was done in the Switzerland, is that sometimes it's not too easy to create this right optimal parameter space. So you want to make this lattice size big enough such that you have the magnetic field, say 10 Tesla ish of the magnetic field, can thread flux quanta into the system. But on the other hand, the properties of this system after this fabrication should be remains as good enough so that there is coherent electrons that exist into this system without a lot of scattering from the impurities in the system, right? And also, you want to create a strong enough electric field modulations to create kind of the gap or the spreading of this lambda lab is big enough so that we can experimentally detect this type of system. Turns out the two-dimensional system, those parameter spaces is such narrow parameter space. So despite a lot of work has been done, well, you can see that there is indeed the lambda lab start to kind of break, split over, and sometimes the splitting, number of the splitting is what you expect from the spectrums. But it's very difficult to show that really, whether this is really shows quantized Hall effect that expected from throughout this system. So that's basically the situation of the experiment by mid-2000. Now, of course, the things got changes when graphene has arrived. Part of the reason is in the graphene, this is a yet two-dimensional system, has kind of interesting this spectrum, but the spectrum itself is not important. But important part of that is because of this linear spectrums and zero mass, when you apply the magnetic field, yes, Landau level forms, but Landau level spacing, especially lowest Landau level, is much larger generally than anything that you can see in the massive system. So at least one energy scale is quite large. And the other one is basically this one is exposed onto the surface, basically not embedded into the some of the layer. So in principle, you can give the rather strong modulation of the periodic electronic structures, periodic electric potentials into the system to create this Hofstadter's problem. The method that we chose, or accidentally we found it, more precisely say that, is if we just combine with graphene with another substrate, such as a boron nitride, one can easily create those kind of periodic modulation into the system about the right length scale. So the graphene has its polymorphism called the boron nitride, which is nothing but just the two carbon atom in the unit cell is replaced by the boron and nitrogen. So in terms of the theoretical language, I would say that you just paint one carbon atom red and the other one is blue, and they are different in terms of the number of the kind of the tendency of the taking electron, which means there is a strong symmetry broken in the graphene languages, which actually opens up the quite a large energy gap into the system, something like the 5 electric volt. So you can treat this as more like an insulator. And putting down the graphene onto the boron nitride, basically graphene supposedly not feel that interferes strongly with this boron nitride because it's an insulator, but locally that this the boron and boron and this nitrogen atoms can create some of the different potentials throughout the system, and depends on how you align them, you may actually get the different result of the potentials. And in fact, if you just align them with a certain kind of twist angle, they just kind of tend to produce not only just local variations, the atomic scale, but over the larger length scale, that they can produce some of the kind of mild modulation of system, what often we call this Moire, the superlattice. The way they experimentally realize those kind of Moire superlattice is rather simple. So you probably heard that how people had prepared the graphene by scotching tape. Believe it or not, still we are doing that after 10 years of the discovery. The part of the reason is still that's the way that you can get the highest quality of sample. There's many different ways you can use CBD, MB, or all this experimental technique. You can still grow the relatively high quality graphene. But still, interesting enough, that still the scotch tape and taping out this single crystal down to the single layer give the highest quality of the graphene sample. Now, we have the bit of the better developed techniques, still using scotch tape, or scotch tape-like the object, more like polymer coating and so on. But now the way that we can do that is once you extract the sample, you can actually lift that sample from the extractions and you can just put any place you want. Now, boron nitride is also a layered system, so you can also cleave it off rather easily. So cleaving off the graphene, cleaving off boron nitride, you can just kind of align them and stack them together. In principle, you can control the angle between the stacking. So you can come up with a system that graphene is sitting on the boron nitride, and you can just connect the wires and you can measure their transport properties. To our surprise, when we did that, first thing we find that is where sample quality becomes much, much better compared with typical sample on silicon oxide. Well, the reason that retrospect is clear that basically boron nitride is a layered system. There's not much interactions between boron nitride and graphene. And moreover, there is no dangling bond on the surface. There is no broken chemical bond on the surface of the boron nitride, nor onto the graphene. Basically, compared with the other surface, when you cut it out to make the surface, usually there's a dangling bond. You have to saturate it out. Usually that saturation coming through some sort of unknown substance, junk, right, which can easily create a disorder potential. That's nothing like that happens for the graphene on the boron nitride, which will make this electron gas quality in the graphene much higher. So in terms of mobility, our mobility value is getting to about 500,000, or even more. Yes? That's right, yeah. So this was not done in our work, but in about the similar time, the other groups actually doing that. In some cases, they indeed can open up the gap if you just align them in the particular case. Especially in the single layer, the boron nitride gives you, in some sense, a symmetry breaking field, and that can open up the gap. And you can say that this drug electrons start to acquire the mass out of the symmetry breaking field. So that can happen.
What is the size of that mass?
Okay, so usually this interaction potentials between graphene and boron nitride depends on the kind of detail of the system, but that's in terms of the energy scale, I would say that's about the energy scale of the 10 Kelvin-ish, 10 Kelvin. So it's not really, really big, but because it's also that probably depends on the 10 Kelvin or 100 Kelvin-ish. But basically, it depends on the what is the tight binding tunneling parameters between this the graphene p orbitals to the boron nitride case, right? Okay. Used to be, suspend graphene has a better quality than anything else. Now the highest boron nitride, the graphene on boron nitride, now catching them up almost. Though I think high density, yes, I think the quality is comparable, but still at the low density regime, especially near the Dirac point, that still the suspend graphene, well optimized, well annealed, the suspend graphene tend to give the better quality of the data, right? So now by just kind of stacking the graphene on the boron nitride, as I said, depends on the different twisting angles. You may have the now different water patterns. It's too small to see this one, but if you just roughly see there's some of the kind of quasi commensuration happens, right? Like hexagonal lattice type of the commensurations. And that will give you the additional super lattice potential, super lattice modulation, if you want to say. And that modulation length, of course, depends on this mismatching angles. So in principle, by controlling this mismatching angle, that you may have the different size of the super lattice you can form up to something like the 10 or 20 nanometer length scale. And that's about the perfect length scale that with about the magnetic field you can apply in the lab, say 10 to 20 Tesla, that's about the perfect length scale you want to have. It's not only just kind of cartoon, but in the reality that when you have the boron nitride and the graphene, if you just use a high resolution atomic force microscope, you can often find out underlying the atomic lattice, which is a bit difficult to see in these AFM images, but there is super lattice modulation. So around kind of 15 nanometers type of super lattice modulation you can see in these images, right? So we know that there is more pattern forms and there is a kind of mild modulation of the long range potential modulation happens like this, right? So once you have this type of long range modulation, what you can see in the experiment is what you expect to see in the band is, of course, this long-range modulation will create the supercell. The unit cell is larger than real unit cells, right? Which means in the Brillouin zone that you have the mini Brillouin zone, and simplest you can just build up the energy band spectrum is you just fold all the band into this mini Brillouin zone, and of course the zone edge of that mini Brillouin zone, there is a modulation of the super lattice potentials will disturb this energy band. Which actually, if you do simple calculation, you can find out. Initially, I have the Dirac cone like this, and this is mini Brillouin zone edges, and around this mini Brillouin zone edges, there is some modulation of the band structure appears. And so in the single layer case, there is the mini Dirac cone actually appears there and so on, right? Well, such a modulation at the zone boundary also give you some differences in the transport. So here is the resistance versus gate voltage. So we can measure on those kinds of samples with the mini Brillouin zone forms due to this more super lattice. Usually in the graphene that you have the one Dirac peak at the resistance. So this peak of the resistance corresponds to the Dirac point. But when this form, this mini Brillouin zone forms, and then there's a disturbance of band, basically outside of the peak, you can often find the additional peaks appears at the hole side and electron side. There is a kind of additional peak appears, presumably due to the disturbance of the band due to this more super lattice. Not only you can see this in the resistance, if you just measured, by the way, also measuring these peak positions from the Dirac point, basically knowing this energy, the gate voltage, in other words, knowing this how much electron you need to feed up to this one, we can actually back calculate what is more super lattice that we expect to see this one and match with the experiment. Actually, they have the regional match. So that's another indication. Indeed, that's coming from those kind of more super lattice Brillouin zone edges, right? And moreover, if you just measure the whole measurement at the same time, whole measurement shows a sine reversal of the whole conductivity, showing that, all right, so now because of this one, I have, originally this is electron-like the band. Electron-like the band turn into the hole-like the band here, and this electron-like band start again, and those kind of things actually appears as a hole measurement as sine reversal of the things. So we know that there is a the kind of the sub-band that forms because of this Moiré super lattice. All right, so that's kind of correspondence we can do. Now, of course, this gives us kind of good ingredient now to realize Hofstadter's spectrum problems, right? Now, at least we have this super lattice, give the, enough the disturbance in the kind of original band, and applying the magnetic field, I need about, say, 10 or 20 Tesla to thread this the flux quanta into the, this super lattice. Indeed, when we apply the magnetic field, strong enough magnetic field, we start to see that there's interesting things comes up. I'm showing you here that both the longitudinal magnetic resistance, RxX, I call that transverse magnetic field, RxY, whole resistance, as a function of the gate voltage and magnetic field, and plotting out the, those two quantities are plotting out by the color code here, right? So dark color code means basically suppressed RxX, zero of the RxX. And what you see here is there's kind of fan comes out from starting from the zero gate voltage correspond to the main drug peak, right? So basically this is a Landau fan diagram we can draw, right? So this is density and this is magnetic field that basically Landau level forms and they flow with the linear in curve, and that's but basically what you're seeing. At the same time, whole conductivity shows plateau like the values, the constant value like this correspond this one. So must be quantum Mohr effect up here. So this is typical Landau fan diagram. But you see that besides this typical Landau fan diagram, there is some interesting things comes around. For example, here that in the side peak position, there is its own Landau level comes out, which is not surprising. Basically, the always this fan started out band edges. So I claim that this is one of the band edges, and then there's a Landau fan comes out. But besides that, you can see that there is some of the fan. It's not coming from this the main drag peak, nor of the this the side peaks. It's coming from somewhere nowhere, basically. So that's actually interesting things. And also, if you look at the whole conductivity, there is some things that the constant magnetic field with a certain line, there are some features kind of nicely lining up. So there are some things coming up, some things unusual in this Venn diagram, right? If you just zoom into the low magnetic field, high resolution, that's obviously even more clear that there's the side fans, but some of the peaks, and it's not coming from the side peaks, and then there's really the features in the well aligned with the constant magnetic field. What are those? Basically, these are the features that are coming from this Hofstadter's spectrum. So the one way that I can show you that this is a quite unusual is the following way. So let me just kind of show the RxX again, right? I will just kind of cut through the constant magnetic field and showing that both RxX and RxY, right? So, and this all this fan, a suppression of the RxX is coming from the quantum Mohr effect. That means actually there should be corresponding RxY, the quantized whole conductance plateau, and the plateau value is related with so-called filling fractions of the Landau level, right? So basically, that's what we know from the simple quantum Mohr effect. So quantum Mohr effect, everything's governed by the filling fraction of the Landau level, and that's nothing but relation between magnetic field and electron density, basically telling that how many Landau level I actually feel, can filled up at given magnetic field with given electric field, given electron density, will give you one single important integer number about the filling fraction nu, and then whole conductivity is governed by these nu numbers, right? So that's basically the quantum Mohr effect. And arming with that idea, if I just look at this constant, the field cut here at the different density, basically what you see here is that RxOx, the whole the magnetic conductance, shows kind of many multiple zeros there, and whenever you have the zero, there is a plateau appears, showing that indeed quantum Mohr effect appears. So it's nothing but just kind of the suppression is quantum Mohr effect. But then I expect to see that there's cross correlations throughout this filling fractions. Indeed, that's the case for the, this electron case, the whole case, right? What you see here is basically filling fraction. I convert this the gate voltage to the density and density to the filling fraction because it's constant magnetic field. And the filling fraction nu equal to correspond to the zero appears, and that's give you the plateau value correspond to 2, is the numerator 2, and 4 give the 4. So in this side, typical just quantum Mohr effect seems works. That's basically this Venn diagram coming from this the Dirac point. But that doesn't work here. if I just look at here, basically 4, 3, 2, and that's not correlated with the plateau value we see. The plateau 4 actually exists until not only 4, 3 up to 1, and plateau 3 appears somewhere that not even these integer numbers, and same as a 2, right? So it's completely wrong. In this case, cannot be explained by the simple quantum effect, right? But if you go back to my first slide, basically that's what we expect, right? What Hofstra's butterfly problem tells you is indeed basically, yes, there is a quantization, but this quantization is explained by two integer numbers rather than one integer numbers. And this Diophantine equations is basically governing this all the quantization in this problem, right? Well, how we can find that quantization? Well, there's a way, because now this the gap is related with these two integer numbers that normalize density and normalize magnetic field. If I normalize then my density and normalize the magnetic field in these units, basically that tells you that what is this two integer number should look like. In other words, I just kind of replot in my Venn diagram such that in the y-axis, the original magnetic field is now given by the quantized, the normalized value of the field and normalized by the normalized density. This was possible because I know that what is my unit cell size is. So I can just replot that with just kind of changing the numbers, right? And those lines that I just draw, the multiple lines, actually I can draw the even more lines in this high magnetic field data, is basically nothing but just following through this line, right? That's kind of a fan. And those kind of things so will follow through the Diophantine equations, which is basically nothing but a couple of the lines in this diagram, right? So if I just kind of draw the line through the sum of the quantization, then what you can see is the slope and the intercept of this line will give you integer numbers. And indeed they do, right? So all of these suppressions and corresponding Rxy that I just kind of find out here and draw the line and find the slope and this intercept will give you automatically two integer numbers, right? Well, it looks rather complicated, and if you just kind of say that, well, if I just draw many, many lines, maybe some of the line may hit these things, right? Complicate data. Well, it's a complex problem. But actually, it's much more serious than what I'm saying. This is having these numbers means actually another meaning, right? Especially let's find out the T number in front, so-called the TKNN number. That's actually related with another experimental observable, such as Hall conductivity. And that governs the whole conductance, whole conductivity, which means if I just kind of plot it out corresponding Rxy and ask what is that value that we expect, so I'm just kind of plotting out that in terms of sigma xy, just kind of reverse of the Rxy. Whenever I hit those kind of lines where the quantum artifact is developed, in other words, suppression of the Rxx happens, right? And there's a quantization appears, right? And the kind of really good quantization in a couple of places like this, right? And then this quantization value is exactly governed by the slope of this one, right? So that's what I'm saying here. So it is not just a random line, but actually really close correlation between them. And they are really well-developed quantum Hall states. But you need two numbers to explain that quantum Hall effect. So that's basically a quite strong experimental presentation that indeed that Hofstra's spectrums and the basic structures in there. Now, actually, there's a more intriguing thing that also comes up. I showed you that another feature is in the Hall conductivity, there is a constant magnetic field. There's some features aligned, right? That's actually even more clear that if I plotted out the Hall conductivity, sigma xy, in terms of the density and magnetic field plots, right? I'm just showing you again. And here that again, clearly there are kind of lines cutting through here that something's happened, right? Bluish color here is basically positive. And so reddish color is positive and bluish color is negative, means that in fact the Hall conductivity shows some reversal along this some constant field lines. Actually, it becomes even clearer that if I just make the cut through this one, that sign reversal is clear. But that line that I was mentioning in this the normalized plot is corresponding simple fraction, such as a half, one third, one fourth, and those kind of simple fractions. In fact, you can easily find those simple fraction numbers. Go back to the Hofstra's initial spectrum. And that's where I just kind of plotted out one of that part, where the basically additional butterfly start kind of pops up there. And that's basically, you can say that around that line, there is a kind of fractal band start to start. What I mean is, basically it's simple fraction. Basically you have, if it's one half, there are two bands. right? And then one third, there's a three band, magnetic bands, magnetic supercells give you three set of the band. But around this one half or one third, basically the continuous bands exist, but right above, right below of that continuous band, basically your band becomes infinitely breaking off, so fractalized. So there are many, many bands actually start to appear right below and right above. So I can say that in that regard, you can view that as a fractal band. And what is interesting thing is the spectrum around there, actually you expect to see the sine reversal happens, and a lot of the mini bands actually appears around that area. What is the experimental implication is, now if I just cut through the one of the constant magnetic field line and cut through the many of the fractal band, what you expect to see, there's a kind of multiple of sine reversal of the whole conductivity. Indeed, I just kind of cut through the one of the distance line, I cut through the disband and band, and then what you see here is RxX, more or less proportional to the density of state, shows a peaks up whenever we cross that band, and at the same time, sigma XY shows a sine reversal, indicating that indeed we are crossing some sort of band. What is quite intriguing thing is, when it actually crosses this band, there's something's happening in the sigma XY. If I just zoom in that, in fact, all of these things is, in fact, itself produce its own quantum Hall effect across it, right? So when we see this one, we have the strong feeling, whoa, quantum Hall effect itself is a recursive around the spectrums. Indeed, showing as an experimentalist, it seems like we feel like really we are seeing some sort of fractal-like features there, right? And if we have the really suppressed disorders and the strongly disordered suppressed disorder, we may see those kind of things even more in if we just zoom in this area. So I think that's kind of showing that indeed this recursive nature is in this spectrums and really closing down the loop that we seems to kind of proving that experimental realization of the this Hofstadter's problem. As I mentioned, that this is a rather single particle-like features, right? But nevertheless, we can also measure all the gaps by just kind of looking at the temperature dependence of this whole conductivity loss, and we can plot it out. What is the gap of this state should look like? So I just kind of just plot it out in, again, normalized Venn diagrams, and then there is a lines correspond to where we see the fractal gap formations. And by just kind of measuring the strengths of the quantum Hall effect, we can assign what is the gap structures, gap size look like. Now, although this is a single particle type of the stories, there's some intriguing stuff that appears that which actually lead into my second topic of my talk, right? All this integer number, you can see the 1, 2, 3, 4, and kind of slope as well as intercept goes 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. Now, one thing I didn't kind of specify clearly in the graphene spectrum, and most of the graphene specialists know that there are some degeneracy in the graphene Landau level, either single layer or bilayer. Usually, this degeneracy comes from the strengths of the energy gap one can create, right? For example, that I mentioned that Landau level is fairly large in the graphene because of this linear dispersion relations, right? So compared to, say, Zeeman energies of the spin, that tend to split in the magnetic field, Landau level spacing is so large. So in most of the case, that we can often ignore just kind of small Zeeman splittings in the problem. So effectively, you can treat spin as degenerating the problem. And also, in the graphene, there are two valleys, either single layer or bilayer, there are two valleys. And they are typically just degenerated because it's two points in the Brillouin zone and they are symmetric. So you can treat that as a kind of another additional degeneracy. So often in the graphene physics, in single particle view, there are four degeneracy per Landau level. Meaning that when I just kind of draw this type of diagram, I usually expect some things only appears in the multiple of the four, right? And when I see that this is not the multiple of four, and then now it says one, two, this means that somehow this degeneracy is lifted, right? In other words, something's broken symmetry is up here there. Somehow the magnetic field, the Zeeman splitting is exceptionally large. Somehow K and K prime see that kind of different type of the energies. So that's what I'm saying here, right? And then often you can see that the, say, one, that's kind of the slope one and the intercept one, that has a fairly large energy, something like the about kind of 50 Kelvin-ish energy. So this circle, size of circle is energy, so this is about 50 Kelvin. compare with some of the other states, say 2 and 2, or some of the other even numbers, sometimes this odd number states, which is maximally symmetric broken state in some sense, is larger than some of these things that even integer numbers that association. Means that already in this spectrum, something is kind of telling us broken symmetries. Now that's actually kind of interesting part, because as I said in the graphene physics, often that the Zeeman energy as a function of magnetic field, and then short range interaction, often then throughout this the impurities or the exchange interactions, they tend to also break the valley degeneracy under the magnetic field. It's much, much smaller than the single particle energy or nor the Coulomb energies, right? So usually this is what we call this kind of A. So we can just say it's 1% of our interesting energies. So we just kind of treat like the degeneracy, right? But seeing these things appears in our spectrums, the Hofstede spectrum, tells us that, well, something go beyond that kind of simple single particle physics there. In fact, that was one of the really important key to get into this many body effect in the graphene under the magnetic field, or even without magnetic field now. Early on, already in 2006, in the early stage of the graphene physics, the Arlans and the Summers and then the Kun Yang actually comes up with the idea that you have to really understand this interesting SU4 physics to understand the interactions in the graphene. Why SU4? Basically, we have the two spinners coming from the real spin and two spinners coming from the spinner coming from valley spins, and you have to even just entangle these two spins together to create a fourth this SU4 space. So basically, this is the internal degree of freedom of the electrons inside the graphene you have to consider. In fact, this actually appears in many cases, and when you just really start to think about the extreme quantum conditions of the electrons inside of the graphene. I mentioned that the Hofstede's problem already showed that sign. That sign becomes even stronger when you get into the extreme quantum conditions, such as where you start to see the fractional quantum Hall effect in graphene. I'm showing you here the typical the quantum Hall effect. You can see that high quality graphene sample under the regional magnetic field, which is 30 Tesla, by the way, right? Then you see that this the quantum Hall effect plateaus appears, and fractional quantum Hall effect plateaus appears. Now already see the 1, 2, 3, 4 of this integer quantum Hall. You say that this is a typical integer quantum Hall, but if you look at the energy gap, they are not typical, because as I said in the graphene, basically I expect to see that like the 2, 6, 10 type of the sequence rather than all broken all integers, simply because of degeneracy arguments. And also there's a sequence of this fraction comes up. In fact, to try to understand these sequences and energy scale, which I'm not going to discuss in detail, you have to really evoke that how this SU4 symmetries and containing this how do you treat exchange interactions together with this SU4 type of the spinner becomes a really important issues that the governing behind of this thing, such as how the energy gap actually evolved with the magnetic field, what is the hierarchy we are seeing in this kind of gap structures. They are all kind of deep into the SU4 symmetries there. More importantly, the quite recent result that the Amir Jacobs group now using their scanning the SAT, they can see the more of the fractions that which is not normally appears clearly in transport measurement, because it's a local measurement and thermodynamic measurement. There's a full flow of these integer sequences can only be explained by just correctly considering this SU4 physics there. I'm not getting into too much of the detail here, but I want to actually mention some things again related with this one. Now, although that I just kind of speak about the mostly graphene single layer, by the way, actually this Hofstede physics I showed you is a bilayer graphene, which is not important for that physics that I'm just discussed. There's a graphene bilayer also can be quite important. And part of the reason is that this you just overlap two graphene layers, single layers, and form this bilayer. The importance comes in that basically a bilayer that they have some small mass, but even with the mass, they tend to be degenerated because of the inversion symmetry in the lattice that you just stack the bilayer away. But this inversion symmetry can be broken by just applying, for example, perpendicular electric field. So it has been known that in simple band calculation, applying the electric field in the vertical direction, you can open up the gap in bilayer spectrum. Now, interesting thing about this operation is, of course, in single particle picture, let's open up the gap. But if I change the languages in terms of the pseudo spin or valley spin under the magnetic field, basically valley spin tied with pseudo spin, which is the A and B sublattice spin, is basically tied with the layers too. In other words, if I apply the electric field and populate the electron hole in the different way in the two layer, basically this is the act like that you can polarize your pseudo spin or valley spin under the magnetic field. So in single layer, basically this additional degree of freedom, why do I call this a pseudo spin in the SU4 space, is basically nothing that easily coupled with that except electron-electron interaction. But having the bilayer, I have additional knob that experiment have, which means basically applying vertical electric field. This is control that I can give you into the spins, the pseudo spin sectors. So I have at least a field act on the pseudo spin. And of course, I have the field act on real spin, right? So I have the knob that I can kind of the control in this SU4 spin space. So that's actually important part in the bilayer. Indeed, experimentally, what this means is if I apply the vertical electric field, if I polarize my pseudo spin, that opens up the gap. And indeed, if you just measure that kind of transport, optical spectrums, and so on, you can see that the gap opens up by applying the electric field. And gap can be as large as something like several hundred millielectrons. Huge gap that can open up in this way, right? But again, in the same token, when you apply the magnetic field, turns out it's not too obvious, but actually they also open up the gap. If you just put into extremely strong magnetic field, somehow that the all this Landau level is broken, including that zero Landau level, they open up the gap, and there is a kind of sample turn into insulator in strong magnetic field. And as you increase the magnetic field, the resistivity goes exponentially up as a function of magnetic field. So in some sense, there are two insulating states I can introduce with a field, right? One is applying perpendicular magnetic field that I turn the sample into the insulator. Another one is applied perpendicular electric field I can come up with insulator. Now, this insulator, pseudo spin polarization insulator, is relatively easy. This is our single particle picture, right? Again, just from band calculation with electric field in vertical direction, I know that how the gap opens up. In fact, actually, theory explained this behavior quite well. How about this magnetic field induced the insulating state? That's actually quite intriguing. In fact, there has been a lot of the theoretical work and experimental work try to address the nature of this the magnetic field driven insulator states. Some of people in this room also contribute quite important issues here. Many experimentalists kind of also attack this problem. Now, if I just summarize some of the languages simply, basically it can be explained in terms of spin languages again. So as I said, under the magnetic field, pseudo spin and valley spins that you tie together, and also that's tied together where electrons live in your sublattice, which carbon atoms electrons tend to sit in, and also in the low energy scale, that is tied with which layer you're sitting in, right? So pseudo spin is nothing but just where in the real space I want to put the electrons. And that there's a real spins that I have to deal with, right? So there are two spin components there. Basically, there are a few different ways that you can create this insulating state. In other words, the gap opens up at the zero energies. So there is a kind of the layer polarized states, and there is an anti-ferromagnetic aligned states or ferromagnetic aligned state. All of these things, in fact, actually rely on that how you want kind of minimize or how you want to maximize exchange energy contributions to minimize the total energies in the many body states, right? Which one is winning actually depends on the bit of the details that system, the material parameters and system details actually govern this, which one is winning in this case. But I should point out at least one state, the one categorization and the other categorization is different. Here that if it is falling to this layer polarizations or the antiferromagnetic aligned, the electron states, basically in terms of the real spin language, this is a spin unpolarized. While the ferromagnetic state, there is a spin polarized state, right? So at least if you just prove that the spin states of the system, you can see that which one is a really ground state in the problems. And moreover, because of I have in the bilayer, more or less I have the field that couples with these two different the spin directions, especially if I just control the strengths of this the spin field, although it is small anisotropy. If I control that anisotropy, maybe there's a chance that I can make the transition from one state to the other states in terms of its own ground states under the magnetic field, right? So there is some rooms that we can do that. So experimenter is a relatively straightforward. What I need to do is I control the two different fields in this problem. So in this case, we have the bilayer graphene sandwiched between two gates. I need two gates because I have to control both density as well as a perpendicular electric field to open up the gap and put into the carrier, the chemical potential inside of the gap. And then I can apply the magnetic field and open up the gap too, right? So first, if I just apply the electric field, I know that open up the gap. And also, I can apply the magnetic field in the vertical directions. And from the previous experiment, we know that that opens up the gap, right? But then I have additional knob that I can use. In other words, now if I just apply in-plane magnetic field, that doesn't do anything about the orbital orders. In other words, it should not touch anything about the exchange interactions, but it's only controlled with the Zeeman field, right, in the lateral directions. And that's actually control the anisotropy in the Zeeman field, which actually can give us some of the additional knob. Now with this, basically this is a data that, again, is a bit complicated data because you see that I can control the density, perpendicular electric field and magnetic field. So it's a three-dimensional parameter space. I'm showing you in the three-dimensional parameter space, cut through some of the data. And this plane is a constant magnetic field and function of displacement field, in other words, perpendicular electric field. And this is control of the density. And color is basically conductance. So blue is conducting. Red is non-conducting or insulating, more insulating. What you see here is that mostly blue, but there's a red part appears. As you go down to low magnetic field, central red part goes away and turn into the blue, right? So conducting, getting to the non-conducting. Conducting, getting to non-conducting. So there are two ways that we can create the gap. That's basically the concept, right? Going in this direction, I get the electric field-driven gap. Going in this direction, I have the magnetic field-driven gap. If I just cut through this central region, basically charge neutrality region that near the zero energy, which is I'm interested in, that's basically cut through this one, actually nicely show the, how these two different phases look like. So this is conducting state I started with. Applying the magnetic field, I get into the red region, which is insulating. Applying the electric field here, that I get into the another red region, this is electric field driven insulating region. Right? So let me mark that as a kind of two different phases. Phase one is E-field-driven insulator, pseudo-spin polarized state. Field two is basically some interesting state that many theorists and many experimenters put a lot of times there, right? So can we actually understand what is going on there? Basically, we can rely on that what is, we know the reason what is going on here. Using that information, we can actually try to address what is going on there. How it works? Basically, as I said, we can apply in-plane magnetic field. Try to increase the Zeeman field as much as possible, right? So that can be done, by the way, tilting the sample in the magnetic field. So it's a relatively simple measurement. So with in plane magnetic field, so what happens? So it's yet another complicated figures, but now I'm taking this top part, so constant perpendicular magnetic field is there, and this axis is now, with the same condition I had there, so simply increasing in plane magnetic field, right? So I start with this, the two different insulating state. As I increase the magnetic field, this becomes weaker. While this color staying the same, this becomes weaker and weaker and turn more like the bluish type of the color, right? In other words, simple languages, well, I had the insulating state in the two turn into conducting states. That's what we are seeing, right? So some sort of things got changes as I increase in plane magnetic field. So what is happening? If I just make this cut again, that's showing the how it actually happens. So I'm just showing the inverse of resistance, in other words, conductance. I plot in terms of the E square of H. Is an insulating state I started with. Well, and small in-plane magnetic field, there is the goes up and goes down. This is the insulating state I was talking about. It's less insulating than this one, but because we probably have, we don't have enough magnetic field. As in-plane magnetic field increases, this insulating state becomes more conducting. That's what is happening here, right? And conducting and conducting and get it saturated. Okay, so that's good. But then you notice that the saturation value is very close to 4 square of H. In fact, actually, the follow-up measurement done at MIT, they actually show that this is a really, really 4 square of H type of numbers, right? So it's a conducting states, but something's happening here, right? In fact, the further measurement shows that this is indeed a metallic state. If you look at the intertemperature dependence, And I'm not going to show you that the details, but follow measurement down. If you just do this measurement in the non-local geometry, indeed, this Foy scale of H is coming from more like edge states of the sample. So it is conducting states, but its conduction is going through the edge of the sample rather than bulk. Basically, that's very close ideas of the close analogies that you can see from this quantum spin-horn effect type of things. Indeed, there is a well-developed kind of theories you can view that. Basically, this one tells you that, well, you start originally, that you start from the antiferromagnetic aligned states, and then when you apply the large enough magnetic field, you turn it to the ferromagnetic states. That explains the, all of the things we expect to see. Because in the original antiferromagnetic state, you expect the bulk, the gap, and there is no edge states. But once you turn that into ferromagnetic states, because of this spin alignment, that you expect this counter-propagating edge states with the spin polarization happens, and those kind of things are what actually match with our experimental observation. So we have the reasonable confidence that now, under the perpendicular magnetic field, that insulating state we start with must be antiferromagnetic state or canted antiferromagnetic state more precisely. And then large enough inflamed magnetic field, we turn that into the ferromagnetic states with these edge states, right? As I said, further measurement done in the MIT follow-up, this work actually shows that really kind of precise quantization and non-local measurement and so on. But yes, I'm almost done. But this actually give us additional kind of interesting things. Again, tie back to the those of the colleagues that interested in the really strongly correlated system in typical the orbital ordered materials. Because here, the system that we have here is kind of interesting, because what I'm saying here is by just controlling the in-plane magnetic field, I have control, I make this transition between antiferromagnetic state to the ferromagnetic states, right? And although you may actually think, well, do you apply the strong enough magnetic field to the align this spin? So it's not ferromagnetic state, but they do. They are the ferromagnetic state. Again, Zeeman energy cannot explain such a large gap that we are seeing in both of the states, right? So in that regard, it is interaction driven. The exchange interaction is extremely important. What is interesting part is just looking at this, the conductivity measurement, I can map out that what is this phase diagram should look like under the two field that I can just apply, right? Here's a magnetic field that changing this the spin anisotropies, and this is a displacement field, basically try to align the pseudo spin. So this is a real spin field, and this is a pseudo spin field. And what you see here is basically originally I have the canted antiferromagnetic states. Of course, if I just apply the strong in-plane magnetic field, that turn into ferromagnetic states. But if I just apply the strong displacement field in pseudo spin sectors, that turn into the so-called layer polarized states. So we can actually map out that what is this phase boundary, which is basically this ear in this kind of conductance measurement, how this one is propagating with in-plane magnetic field. I can map it out, these kind of the phase boundary between these two, right? Moreover, now all this energy scale is governed by exchange energies. And then I have the knot that tune the exchange energies. That's basically a vertical magnetic field, because that's governing that distance between the electrons I have, right? All of this experiment, I fix the perpendicular magnetic field. Now, if I start tune this perpendicular magnetic field, that change exchange energy scale, which will just kind of change this boundary between the phases. Especially important boundary between the phases is how this canted antiferromagnet turns into ferromagnet. Presumably second order type or the crossover, so I don't know what is the exact nature, but that boundary will be changed by the exchange magnetic, changing the exchange interactions throughout the changing vertical magnetic field. Indeed, if we just change the vertical magnetic field, we can see that those kind of phase boundary got kind of pushed over. That relation can be kind of nicely captured in this diagram, how this phase boundary got changed over with the perpendicular magnetic field, showing that what is the effect of the changing, tuning the exchange interactions on this phase boundaries and so on. So this is kind of interesting model system. You can just try to understand this the phase transition between these two phase boundaries. All right, so I think that's probably all I want to say. And there are a few other things going on. Maybe we can actually continue on some of the, to look at this interesting, the many body effect, not only transport measurement, one can do other type of the thermodynamic measurement using this, say, thermal power, which is sensitive to this entropy type of things. And also we can do with this mechanical measurement, which also can pick up this depth chemical potential changes and so on. But given the interest of time, let me skip all this quite intriguing and experimental details. But the conclusion is, well, so again, graphene is a rather interesting and intriguing system. It gives us a really high quality two-dimensional electron gas with a lot of technical advantages we have, which we haven't had in the two-dimensional system, which actually allows us to kind of solve some of the interesting quantum mechanical problem. But also now, given driving this the two-dimensional system into the extreme quantum condition, we also see that extremely important role of the interactions in this kind of system. Thank you very much.
Your measure, so
the electric conductance zero, and you don't have a small conductance.
That's right. So the whole conductivity here is all zero, right? So basically,
it's new. So I think a whole conductivity is zero indeed. Although that zero is very difficult to measure in terms of whole conductivity, because in this case, the RxX is diverging, usually the case. But we can reasonably claim the experimentally zero. Now, in principle, that if you just measure the spin hole type of the effect, you may be able to see this one. But we don't have the really good spin measurement that can be done. So we don't know that whether that's a really experimentally true. But the other part, that this non-local measurement also tells you that at least there must be some the edge state to do exist in the ferromagnetic state. So existence of the edge states and the zero of the electric hole conductance was measured experimentally.
If it's the edge conductance, it will be kind of geometry. So exactly where your probe.
Yes, I wish that I have that slide with me, but that's what I'm saying. That's what people did on the non-local measurement. Whether you put this contact here, contact there, whether there is a contact or no contact, basically you get the different conductance. And there's So there's a beautiful experiment that has been recently confirmed that indeed there is edge states associated with this ferromagnetic states.
So there's another related issue with that. Maybe spin onto effect is very weak. But what I have said, if there is a spin onto effect, again, it's a 4E over H.
That's right.
That's right.
So that's actually a very good point. In fact, when Charles Kane and Jane Mill actually comes around this topological engineering idea, they actually attack the graphene problems first.
Yeah.
And if there is a finite spin orbit couplings, and indeed numerical zero states that we are seeing here, also kind of due to the spin orbit coupling, naturally turn into the topological engineering type of the counterpropagating states. Unfortunate part is the spin orbit couplings in graphene is extremely weak because it's so light elements and this p orbital. There's not in the wave function in the nucleus part, and basically make this spin orbit couplings in general quite weak.
But actually, I'm talking about another effect.
Right.
Without spin orbit coupling, this spin hole effect would guarantee this H4E.
Right.
But the spin orbit coupling may cause backstabbing.
That's right.
So
there
is a way to destroy it.
That's right.
And So I wonder whether in some very low temperature or some very clean sample,
so if I
see this deviation from H4E.
I think there is a slight debate about what is the strength of the spin orbit coupling in the graphene, but it's reasonably believed that much less than millikelvin temperature ranges. So experiment is rather difficult, right? Yeah.
Can you say anything about how this competition between two states varies as you decrease the perpendicular field?
Okay, so do I remember that? I think probably that's this one, right?
That's the lowest field at which you've done detailed measurements, I guess.
Yeah, so let's see. This is a 10 Tesla, 5 Tesla, and 0 Tesla. So the field is decreasing in this direction.
Mm-hmm.
And the space boundary actually tend to decrease. So the space boundary is pushed back as I decrease the perpendicular magnetic field. So in other words, I think, let me make sure. So the decreasing perpendicular magnetic field is a decreasing exchange interactions, and that actually pushes this phase boundary in that direction. I don't know what does it mean theoretically, but that's actually experimental observation we have, right?
Okay.
that the gap persists to zero field?
We don't have the really kind of extremely low magnetic field data. So I think that we measure here up to about the one Tesla-ish. And there's you can say that there's the soft gaps there. Of course, the gap actually decreases with the decreasing magnetic field. So the particular measurement that we are doing is not too sensitive about the gap size in such a low magnetic field. But I tend to say, yes, the gap seems to be there. But what is another important issue here is, of course, there are yet another strong the interest, that actually even more interesting, that what if that zero magnetic field and zero electric field, whether there is a really spontaneous magnetic the symmetry broken there, whether that is connected with something we are seeing in the finite magnetic field, that's something we don't know. Experimentally, it's rather difficult to claim anything in that direction because we don't have enough resolution to connect that part.
We're starting to eat into our coffee break, but maybe we can have a couple more questions.
Yeah.
maybe it's experiment very difficult at the moment. Are you planning to see fractional Hall effect in the butterfly?
So I think that's an obvious next kind of agenda. So we wish to see that whether will there be a fractional quantum Hall effect, or that is it, if there is a fractional quantum Hall effect, do we expect to see again? So sort of kind of we need more quantum numbers there. We don't see that yet, evidence yet, and I believe that we may need even kind of higher quality samples to do that. But certainly that's our agenda. But I would say that for the truth theorist, you should kind of come up with the answer before we give you the experimental data. I think, but that's actually extremely interesting questions, indeed.
Okay, Eduardo. So in the zero field limit, there is another. So the zero perpendicular field limit.
Yes. Yeah.
There is another source of which of metallicity, which is if you apply the parallel field.
Yeah. So that's a.
You
that's
will
a,
break the point group symmetry.
So that's a. Right. So. I think that the nature of these states of the bilayer graphene, a zero magnetic field and zero electric field, is strongly under the debate in the graphene community. I can understand that among the theorists there is always a debate. So that's but the problem is that's also strong debates under the even among the experimentalists. Some experimentalist groups see the insulating state. Some experimentalists see that metallic state. So it's a rather complicated situation.
There is a weak coupling instability that can either open a gap or actually split the crossing.
Yeah.
Now, if you apply an in-plane field, you're breaking essentially the rotational symmetry
sure.
by hand,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's possible that some of your metallic states actually are due to the splitting.
Maybe.
And not
yeah.
necessarily
yeah.
to an edge
yeah.
effect.
Yeah.
In that sense.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how to connect that into the zero field. I originally we wish that some of the things that we see here can be connected to the zero field and zero field limit. But seems like unless we have the more data, there is a possibility. I agree, but whether I can say something with it based on the experimental data, that I don't
also
know.
Also, a related issue even in this fractional regime, or in the integer regimes that you study
yeah.
in the
yeah.
plane fields.
Yeah.
Do you see an isotropic
transport? Not that we noticed, but honestly speaking, that we haven't really geared our experimental systematic literature try to look at the anisotropies, yes. such as kind of some stripes or bubbles and those kind of phases yes. in gallium arsenide. I cannot say with confidence, but. Throughout the many measurements we've been seeing, we didn't notice that there is a strong anisotropies in plane anisotropy you are seeing. So that's up to there, I guess.
Doesn't seem to care about which way you measure it.
Seems like right. Although we didn't do completely systematic studies to really disprove or prove the one or the other. But so far. Yeah.
Okay, so why don't we break for coffee now and thank you both again.
Thank you.